Good evening, folks, and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's see if we can't try to wrap our heads around a week where big lies or whoppers, even the popular fake news, doesn't even come close to describing what we've been seeing. And when it comes to those big lies, we have such a target-rich environment that it's almost tough to know where to start. But I guess we have to do it this way. This is the week where the so-called Republicans in the Senate pulled out nuclear weapons against an outsider that, ironically, was said to be one of their own. But then you had Mitch McConnell, among others, saying the hell with the voice of the people, because even if Judge Roy Moore gets elected to the Senate from Alabama, we won't seat him, because he doesn't meet our high moral standards. Like, well, Senator Al Franken does, who pontificates about sexual abuse while he yucks it up on a USO flight taking pictures of himself grabbing the breasts of a sleeping Leanne Tweeden, who was pretty upset about being, quote, groped without my consent while I was asleep, as the news broadcaster and sports announcer discovered when the photos came out after they landed. This week, a former Secret Service agent assigned to Vice President Joe Biden's residence, wasn't he a senator too, come to think of it, came out and revealed what a slimy, perverted predator he is, to the extent that the service often had to protect female agents from him, and none of them wanted their wives or girlfriends to be in the guy's presence. But come on, folks, we're used to that kind of hypocrisy, aren't we? We see it literally every day, and we have our noses rubbed in it. This came out at the end of the week about how Congress quietly settled any number of sexual harassment suits, amounting to, oh, a dozen or more annually over the last 20-some-odd years, to the tune of millions and millions of taxpayer dollars, in order to prevent Americans from learning just what slimy hypocrites they really are. But for some pretty obvious reasons, folks, the Judge Roy Moore lynching really bothers your host. I'm looking at a great piece by Chuck Baldwin via LouRockwell.com, Chuck Baldwin Live, and other places. He entitled it, "The National Republican Party is Pathetic," but there's more to it than that, in which he introduces the story by observing that the CIA tied Bezos Washington Post, or WAPO, ran their hit piece on Moore concerning allegations by teenagers, at least they were 40 years ago, that they had been touched sexually and or hugged and kissed by Moore when he was a deputy DA in Alabama, and why they waited for decade after decade and election after high-profile election after election to finally come forward might be obvious to some, but it's not been reported. I mean, really, it's not like Judge Moore has a bimbo erections. Oops, let me try that again. It's not like, and I'm having trouble getting that out straight. It's not like Judge Moore has a bimbo eruption squad, thank you, Hitlery, to deal with his peccadilloes, nor does he have a list of Arkansas, like some folks seem to. In other words, we're not talking about rape and the kind of subsequent coercion that people like Juanita Broderick, Kathleen Willey, Paula Jones, Jennifer Flowers, and a host of others have alluded to, involving everything from economic threats and public humiliation to, yeah, having their dead pets show up on their front doors as a warning. As those who don't read the WAPO, listen to NPR, or watch CNN may have heard regarding a former well-known White House sexual predator. The point here, folks, is the disconnect. The level of relative criminality involved. It's a little bit like hearing a bunch of mafia drug lords dissing a 5-year-old girl for selling overpriced lemonade at a stand out in front of her house. And then it turns out they're lying about that, too. Back to this piece by Chuck Baldwin. He quotes any number of people who have pointed out, as I've already alluded to, that this alleged hugging and kissing took place 4 decades ago, and it hasn't come out until now because the establishment is finally really, really worried. Roy Moore seems to be the real deal. And furthermore, if people are actually starting to wake up to their perfidy, that would be really bad. They might actually get serious about getting rid of some of the crocodiles in the swamp. Furthermore, SonsOfLiberty.com's Tim Brown writes that the so-called Washington Post reporter who broke this hit piece also has a rap sheet of her own. She's been charged with 4 infractions of writing bad checks in at least 3 states. And in North Carolina, the so-called reporter was convicted of a crime punishable by up to 6 months in prison. It seems, he notes, that this woman went from writing fake checks to writing fake news. Furthermore, Although the WAPO doesn't seem to be interested in telling you too much about it, along with most of the rest of the waste stream, the star accuser against Roy Moore, who claims he improperly touched her and tried to get her to touch him improperly, has a history of falsely accusing Christian men of sexual improprieties. Some of her neighbors even said that making false sexual accusations is the pattern for this woman. Apparently, she's accused at least 4 Alabama pastors in the past of sexual wrongdoing. Each time, an investigation found that she was lacking credibility, and the accusations were dismissed, and on one of those occasions, an Alabama Circuit Court judge refused to even hear the case, because the woman had been determined to be a chronic liar and false accuser. This, in other words, is exactly what we're seeing play out now on a national level. And the hypocrisy is literally beyond belief. This next item is a great story, but originally I hadn't planned on including it in the summary this week, simply because most of it you've heard. But given all of that, I do think it's more important than ever to recap the level of perfidy we're dealing with here. This piece comes from former federal judge Andrew P. Napolitano. Lou Rockwell entitled it, More Hitlery Chronicles. And it starts like this. The Department of Justice will soon commence an investigation to determine whether there should be an investigation. Yeah, you read that nonsense correctly, he says, of a scandal involving the Clinton Foundation and a company called Uranium One. It appears that FBI decisions made during the time that Hitlery was being investigated for espionage will also be investigated to see whether there should be an investigation to determine whether she was properly investigated. Yeah, ditto, you read it right. Again, only the government, he said, can relate such nonsense with a straight face. But here's the rest of the story. When President Donald Trump fired the scumbag FBI director, I put that in there, Hormeister James Comey last spring, the Attorney General's stated purpose for recommending the firing was that Comey dropped the ball in the investigation of Clinton's email when she was Secretary of State. After a year of investigating her use of her own computer servers to transmit and store classified materials instead of a government server, and notwithstanding a mountain of evidence of her grossly negligent exposure of secret and top-secret materials, which of course constitutes an actual crime, espionage, the FBI director nevertheless decided that because no reasonable prosecutor would take the case, it ought to be dropped. And that, of course, was consistent, your host notes again, with Loretta Lynch Mob meeting with Bill Clinton on the tarmac in Phoenix. At the same time that Clinton was failing to safeguard state secrets, though, she was granting official State Department favors, says Napolitano, to donors to her family's charitable foundation. Dozens of examples exist of what's been called pay-to-play, but the most egregious is probably the Uranium One case, which involved a Canadian businessman and friend of former President Bill Clinton's, Frank Giustra, who bundled donations from various sources that totaled almost $150 million, all of which Giustra gave to the Clinton Foundation. And at the same time that Giustra made this extraordinary donation, he was representing a client that needed federal permission to purchase a 51% stake in Uranium One, which then controlled about 20% of America's licensed uranium mining capacity. Secretary Clinton freely gave Giustra's client the State Department's approval, and it soon acquired the remaining approvals to make the purchase. Giustra's client is, I hope you're sitting down, a Russian corporation controlled by the Kremlin. And when the FBI got wind of the Giustra donation and Secretary Clinton's approval and the Kremlin involvement, it commenced an investigation of whether Clinton had been bribed. At some point during President Barack Obama's second term, that investigation was terminated. We don't know whether the investigating FBI agents learned that the Clinton Foundation wasn't even registered as a charity by the states in which it was doing business or authorized by them to receive tax-free donations. But at the same time that the FBI was looking into Uranium One, both American and British intelligence agencies were surveilling Donald Trump. The stated purpose of that surveillance, belatedly, was to ascertain whether the future president, by that time they knew it, even if America hadn't realized the fix wasn't going to be enough, or his colleagues were engaged in any unlawful activity by accepting campaign favors from foreign nationals or improperly assisting foreign intelligence agents to interfere with the presidential election. Yeah, we know whose job that was. One of the foreign nationals whose communications were captured during that surveillance was Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the U.S., who spoke with Michael Flynn, then National Security Advisor to President-elect Trump, Mysteriously, though, portions of that transcript, intercepted communications, ended up being published in the Washington Post. He goes on to talk about others here, including the infamous Christopher Steele and the Trump Golden Showers dossier and so forth and so on, like the infamous Fusion GPS connection. FBI tried to buy that one. And as all of that has come out, the rhetoric against other people for far lesser offenses has not only been accelerated, but shouted endlessly from the rooftops. Napolitano makes another interesting point here. Can the government investigate itself? He says, well, we've seen lots of examples, no doubt on that score. But in this case, says the judge, none of these claims, even though the crimes are very serious, literally amount to the type of conflict that would exist when the president is being targeted. Especially, I can't help but think, when he's being targeted by a co-conspirator. I'm thinking Robert Mueller, just in case it's not obvious. And none of that, therefore, requires an independent counsel. All it would require, if we had an attorney general, was for the Department of Justice to get to work and do the job they were supposed to be doing all along. We didn't see it before during the Obama tenure, and sadly, now that Jeff Sessions is in there, we're still not seeing it. But what we are seeing are whoppers galore. This next item isn't particularly high on the newsworthiness scale, but it certainly may be the most hypocritical comment that I've ever heard, even from the likes of a Hillary Clinton, where hypocrisy is a way of life. I've kind of been working up to it, and this one's so bad that we need to set the stage. The idiot interviewer from Mother Jones actually begins the question by saying that President Trump is trying to flip the script, if you can believe that, by daring to suggest that it's Hitler and company, including the Clinton Foundation, who should be investigated for the corruption associated with Uranium One, rather than Robert Mueller's politically motivated witch hunt, claiming to look for election manipulation by the dreaded Ruskies in spite of a total lack of evidence. Unless you count evidence of things like conflicts of interest by accusers.
As you know, President Trump has tried to flip the script and now says the Justice Department should be investigating you. Mm-hmm. And this week we learned that Attorney General Sessions is considering a special counsel to probe the Uranium One deal and alleged conflicts with the Clinton Foundation. What's your reaction to this?
You know, I regret deeply that this appears to be the politicization of the Justice Department and our justice system.
No, it wasn't Bill and Loretta on the tarmac, or even Debbie Wasserman Schultz or Lois Lerner getting away, thanks to a corrupt Justice Department, with politicizing the IRS. I know, you're probably thinking that is the hypocrisy I was referring to. No, folks, we're just now getting started. After lying through her teeth about how these are not the droids you're looking for, no, there's nothing there with Uranium One, and Bill's $500,000 payoff, quid pro quo, was just business as usual, which at least is close to the truth, she has the in-your-face hubris to trot this out. How dare these people think they could investigate me for anything, regardless of how much evidence there may be?
If they send a signal that we're going to be like some dictatorship, some authoritarian regime, where political opponents are going to be unfairly, fraudulently investigated, that rips at the fabric of the contract we have, that we can trust our justice system.
And I guess this snippet wouldn't be complete without, what do you call this? The kind of hypocrisy that rubs people's noses in it?
As Secretary of State, I went around the world bragging about America's rule of law.
Yeah, because I own it and I ran it.
That we were a nation of laws, not of men.
But I'm a woman who can get away with anything. And she proved it, too.
You know, the justice system was blind.
Especially when you can undermine national security, commit treason, and then bleach-bitch your hard drives, and then smash what's left into smithereens with hammers right in front of the FBI. How's that for blindness?
Obviously, you know, we were proud of that, but we had to always be vigilant to make sure that it remained so.
And evidently they weren't quite vigilant enough because they couldn't rig the election against the kind of landslide that exposed all of her wickedness.
Ah, you cursed rat! Look what you've done! I'm melting! Melting! Oh, what a world! What a world! Who would have thought a good little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness? Ah!
As Secretary of State, I went around the world bragging about America's rule of law, that we were a nation of laws, not of men. And, you know, the justice system was blind, and obviously, you know, we were proud of that, but we had to always be vigilant to make sure that it remained so.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
President Trump calls her crooked Hitlery, and he's far, far too kind. Yet another gun-free killing zone mass murder in California again to boot by the usual lone nut gunman. And here's something we've heard before, too. There were actually multiple shooters reported, but once the fake news media gets the narrative under control, we're back down to what we've come to expect. So it took a few hours, but now, in spite of eyewitness reports to the contrary, we're back down to the official lone nut gunman. Even though there were shots fired at least four different locations, they have a problem with the timeline. We'll see whether they can make sure they're all sequential or not with enough time in between. And since this one's not likely to get the level of scrutiny that Las Vegas did, we're not as likely to hear much more about it. So here's what's emerging now as the official narrative, courtesy of the Daily Mail out of the UK. Five dead in a mass shooting in Northern California. The gunman was, quote, out on bond for stabbing a woman, no problem there, and then goes on a rampage shooting neighbors and children at an elementary school in four different locations around the town. And, of course, back to the other narrative, he was supposedly shot and killed by police at the school on his final deadly stop. According to local coverage from KHSL-TV and neighbors, the shooter was known to police and was out on bail for stabbing a female neighbor when he committed the killings on Tuesday, starting at 7:52 a.m. with some shots fired at Bobcat Lane. Then there was a person shot a few blocks north at Stagecoach Road. A little ways from there, a woman and her child were shot in another car, followed at least allegedly by a number of shootings where children were injured at Rancho Tahama Elementary School. The problem with all of this is revealed by a compilation of news reports by Dave Hodges at the Common Sense Show, who starts with an eyewitness report from Coy Ferreira, whose daughter's a kindergarten student. He was dropping his daughter off for class just before 8 a.m. Gee, that's pretty far away from the first shooting at 7:52 for just 8 minutes, isn't it? When he heard what sounded like a firecracker. Whereupon he ran into a classroom with 14 students and said a series of shots came through the classroom windows, hitting one. A young boy was shot in the foot and the chest. Ferreira said that at this point, on the north end of town, there were two gunmen. He saw one of them, a man in his 30s or 40s dressed in green camo, running away from the school after the shooting. Separately, he added that he believes the gunman, or at least one of them, would have had to have shot from an elevated ramp in order to see students who were hiding under their desks. Another witness named Tiffany, who operates a coffee shop near the school, told KRCR News Channel 7 she heard between 90 and 100 shots fired and reported seeing a Honda drive by with the windows shot out and at least five ambulances responding to the area. Her husband, Brian Rogers, said another witness reported seeing a white pickup truck drive through the school gate and start shooting from that one. But hey, folks, I guess those people didn't get the memo, and they're just reporting what they actually saw as opposed to what they're going to later be told they were supposed to have seen. Color me really skeptical, too. So with that as an intro, let's go to a previous false flag where the official narrative is in such tatters that the waste stream just basically gave up on trying to push it down people's throats. This piece comes from Jay Sermopoulos, again at the Freethought Project, entitled 10 Compelling Reasons Why the Las Vegas Shooting Has Just Plain Disappeared from the Headlines. Number 1, the official timeline for the mass shooting has changed at least three different times since the official narrative was, well, re-released. Patsy Paddock wired $100,000 to an account in the Philippines a week prior to the massacre, and the authorities admit that his laptop was missing its hard drive. Wonder if Hitlery got it. When they found it in his hotel room, Paddock reportedly took cruises that made multiple port stops in the Middle East, and now officials are claiming that an officer, we actually heard this report in the beginning, but it was denied, discharged his weapon in Paddock's hotel room after all, and after denying it for the first month following the attack. There's a whole lot about the hero security guard Jesus Campos that just doesn't pass the smell test. That takes care of several of these. An attorney for the victims has noted that the MGM Grand hotels have a corporate watch center that trains employees to report any suspicious activity. So you have to wonder, how can a guest arrive at the Mandalay Bay Hotel with 27 rifles, 5,000 rounds of ammunition, and 10 different bags? And why didn't the employees who helped him, or the cleaning service who visited his room regularly for however many days it supposedly was, report any suspicious activity? As if at least one reason isn't pretty obvious. And why is there no investigative coverage of the continued stonewall surrounding what they call the biggest mass shooting in U.S. history, except for those Big Brother commits and lies about, like a church in Waco, Texas. One more now, collected by ENE News. Radioactive contamination in the Tokyo metropolitan area in the early stage of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant accident, meltdown, and cover-up was much worse than admitted. And no, we're not talking about the 12th or 15th or who knows how manyth time they kept saying, well, the real story is that it's worse than our previous lies. But in this case, radiation near Tokyo, says the headline, spiked to 100 million times normal after Fukushima. The quotes say things like extremely high levels were detected and intensive contamination did hit the Tokyo area, all the while radioactive contamination information was hidden from the public. Which brings me to the question du jour. Why do they lie? Arguably some things, like liability or just because they love doing it, are excuses. It's because they know that even decades later, if they admit the degree of perfidy, just how thick the lies were and how bad the cover-up's been, people might not trust them today. And there are plenty of continuing cover-ups that need to be, well, covered up. A whopper follow-up now, via Fox News and others. At least five, probably six, and probably a whole lot more than that, foreign nationals with suspected ties to terror resettled in the U.S. through the same visa lottery program that allowed the most recent high-profile terror suspect Saifullah Saipov into the country, said the Trump administration on Tuesday. Saipov, of course, is the infamous ISIS sympathizer who allegedly committed that Halloween terror attack with a truck in Lower Manhattan, leaving 8 dead and 11 more injured, who entered the U.S. from Uzbekistan in 2010 through the infamous visa lottery program pushed by the notorious gun grabber and constitutional terrorist Chuckie Schumer. That visa lottery program, in case you have forgotten, is known as the Diversity Visa Waiver Program, and it grants up to 50,000 potential terrorists immigrant visas drawn from, and here I quote, random selection among all entries to individuals who are from countries with low rates of immigration, unquote, to the U.S. Random candidate selection, says the State Department, is through a computer-generated drawing for foreign nationals, most of them, of course, antithetical to the principles that were once unanimously agreed upon by the founders as forming the basis for law in this nation. The Trump administration has identified a number of other terrorist suspects randomly selected through the visa lottery to permanently settle, at least until they kill somebody and get arrested again, in the United States. According to the Department of Just Us on October 27th, just days before Saipov's attack in New York City, another Uzbek national and visa lottery winner, Abdurasul Hasanovich Yorobov, was sentenced to 15 years in prison after pleading guilty to conspiring to provide material support to the Islamic State. Another visa lottery winner, Syed Haris Ahmed, Pakistani national, was convicted of terrorism related to activities in the U.S. and abroad all the way back in 2009. As you know, President Trump's been vocal in criticizing the program and called for its elimination, but he's tried to eliminate other things that Big Brother's progressives won't allow him to do, because some two-bit judge in the Ninth Circus or elsewhere has an imperial pen that's mightier than the president's. We're not done with the list yet, and I won't go through all of them, but the one thing that they all seem to have in common is a name that, well, if I read them all, I'd probably be called Islamophobic. In any case, the program originated as part of a bill introduced in 1990 by Senate Minority Leader and the infamous gun grabber and terror supporter Chuckie Schumer of New York, then a House member. The bill to make a number of visas available to so-called diversity immigrants, and we now know what that means, was absorbed into a larger House immigration bill and eventually passed and signed by President George Herbert Walker Bush, who did sign that but certainly wouldn't have signed the Declaration of Independence. So what's the larger point here? Yeah, even the name of this so-called diversity lottery program is a great big whopper of a lie. Once Americans held certain truths universally and unanimously to be self-evident. And now, of course, Sharia, whether Big Brother's minions lie about it to your face or not, is absolutely positively antithetical to that, because the very concept that underlies it is, there is no God but Allah, submit or die. We know better here. We'll be right back.
Wonder I can think at all, and my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Hold a throne.
Welcome back again. This is your host, Mark Hall, and since we ended on this note, let's pick it up right where we left off. At least when it comes to Whoppers, the Ministry of Truth, and things that people are going to be forced to accept whether they believe it or not. And we'll get back to the Islamic invasion aspects of that in a few minutes. A woman in the Claremont School District of California, and right there you see at least two mistakes, says she was approached by an official from the Claremont School District while she was walking her children to the bus stop, like she does every day, and he had a police officer with him too. And she's got the video to prove it, and it's gone viral on the web, which is a good thing. In a very intimidating fashion, says the summary by Michael Snyder, they began questioning her, Achtung, about whether or not her school children had been vaccinated. And when she refused to answer and started recording the interaction, they walked away. But that wasn't the end of it. Later, she called the police department and explained what was going on, suggesting that she was being harassed, and the response was, you ain't seen nothing yet. She was told that in the People's Republic of California now, she could be arrested for refusing to vaccinate what she thought were her children. Quote, I called the police department to try to make a complaint for harassment, she said, and was told by the sergeant that me not giving my kids shots is a criminal act and that I will be arrested. Unquote. Is it true? Are things really that far gone in California? Or are the police just lying again and intimidating people because they think they can get away with it? The irony here is that the intimidation certainly matters a lot more than the law. Remember, people can bust down your door and kill your dog. They don't need a warrant for that, regardless of what the law says. So arguably, we're getting to the point where regardless of what the law says, it's probably safe to conclude that whether or not they can actually arrest people for this, they can obviously make their lives miserable and try to scare them. And when you threaten a young mother with taking away her children or arresting her for doing what she thinks is right, it's pretty much the same thing. Michael Snyder observes that this is precisely the kind of thing that health freedom advocates were warning would happen in California. That's pretty much the same thing as a conspiracy theorist, and as you might suspect, it was pretty much a lead pipe cinch that they'd be proven right, and now they have. Here next, another story to set the tone that's almost as disgusting and arguably no less surprising. This one comes from Zero Hedge, and it's about the Army, which has again lowered their recruiting standards, sick. This time to allow soldiers with a history of self-mutilation and bipolar disorder to be all that they can be. Almost makes you wonder if they'd get special preference if they happened to claim they were transgendered, too. Since the beginning of the year, much ink has been spilled about the Army's increasingly desperate attempts to fulfill its lofty recruiting quotas for the fiscal year 2017 through 18, that is, 80,000 new soldiers. And to hit that number, the Army has repeatedly loosened its recruiting requirements, notably under the Obama regime, but it looks like the same people are still there, and the process continues. Last month, the military introduced yet another new policy that would forgive recruits with a history of marijuana use and certain related criminal violations. Now, though, the military is taking those efforts one step further. USA Today reports that the Army has expanded its criteria for granting waivers to certain recruits who violate criteria related to mental health violations, like having a history of bipolar disorder or self-mutilation. The military said this expansion is justified by the, and it's hard to read this, folks, but I'll get through it. It's justified by the increasing availability of your medical records. Yes, we know what you have been doing, whether you like it or not, and whether you think HIPAA privacy applies. Allowing recruiters, it claims, to analyze a potential recruit's history in greater detail to make a more accurate assessment as whether or not they're fit to serve. Seems, folks, like it's almost as easy to get into the military as it is to get into the country. While it's unclear, writes Tyler Durden in Zero Hedge, just how long this decision was under consideration, last year, Jeff Snow, the Army Major General who's in charge of the branch's recruiting program, revealed to Arizona Central that only 3 in 10 individuals applying to join the Army actually meet the branch's, quote, rigorous, unquote, recruiting requirements. And you know what, folks? Your host can't help but suspect that says far more about the state of physical and mental health among the younger generations than it does about the Army's rigorous requirements. Which, a lot like snowflake mental fitness, does seem to be in a continued state of decline. To meet last year's recruiting goal of 69,000 people, the Army accepted more recruits who fared poorly on aptitude tests and increased the number of waivers granted for marijuana use and offered hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses. Lieutenant Colonel Randy Taylor, Army spokesman, said in a statement that expanding the waivers for mental health is possible, at least in part, because the Army now has access to more medical information about each potential recruit. And the story notes that the Army issued the ban on waivers back in 2009 amid an epidemic of suicides among troops. Says Zero Hedge, despite the Army's claims that it now possesses the tools to conduct more advanced screenings of individual candidates, up until, say, some lone nutcase judge in the Ninth Circuit says they can't, one expert on military waivers pointed out that no amount of precise data about recruits' health history can definitively prevent those issues from resurfacing later. Self-mutilation is a particularly disruptive issue because it could set off alarms about potential suicide attempts or other similarly disruptive phenomena. Said Elsbeth Ritchie, psychiatrist who retired from the Army as a colonel in 2010 and an expert on waivers for military service, quote, it's a red flag. The question is, how much of a red flag is it? Your increasingly cynical host, of course, who's been watching this and related issues for a long time now, can't help but ask one more question. Given the number of false flags that we've seen of late, and the overwhelming stench associated with so many of those, is it just possible that candidates who wouldn't have qualified for military service to their country, back when recruits pretty much universally understood what it meant to take an oath before God to preserve the Constitution against all kinds of enemies, may now get a green light because there are all kinds of missions that wouldn't have been considered back when we were a nation of law, not of men? Next, I want to spend a few minutes today on an interesting story. I saw it aggregated by Zero Hedge, but it comes from Raul Ilargi Mayer via the Automatic Earth blog, and it's entitled, Google and Facebook Are 1984. He begins by quoting what he calls a light critique of social media by Claire Wardle and Hossein Darakhshan for the London Guardian, entitled, How Did the News Go Fake? Well, when the media went social. Because, as they put it, social media forces us to live our lives in public, positioned center stage in our own very own daily performances. Before our media became social, only our closest friends or family, they write, knew what we read or watched, and if we wanted to keep our guilty pleasure secret, we could. But now, what you like is basically going to be what you get fed, or penalized for. All of that, says author Mayer, just sets the scene. Because people sell their lives and even their souls to join a network that then sells these lives and souls to the highest bidder. For a profit, those people get nothing themselves out of. And that's not some far-fetched idea. As noted in some detail later in this piece, in terms of scale, Facebook is literally, are you sitting down, folks, a present-day Christianity. And these concerns are not only from concerned citizens, but early participants too, like Facebook co-founder Sean Parker, and we quoted him at length last week in a piece entitled, God Only Knows What Facebook Is Doing to Our Children's Brains. He went into some detail about how they designed it to be as addictive and time-wasting as possible. Looks like they were quite successful. It's a social validation feedback loop, he said, exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with, because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. And he noted that the creators and inventors, including himself and Zuckerberg, understood this consciously and, quote, did it anyway. One of the most interesting quotes in here, though, comes from an early-stage investor in Facebook, Roger McNamee, who also wrote along the same lines as Parker for The Guardian. in a piece that he called How Facebook and Google Threaten Public Health. Oh, and Democracy. Saying the term addiction used by Parker is no exaggeration. The average consumer checks his or her smartphone 150 times a day, making more than 2,000 swipes and touches. The applications they use most frequently are owned by Facebook and Alphabet, can you say Google, and the usage of those products is still increasing. In terms of scale, Facebook and YouTube are similar worldwide to Christianity and Islam, respectively. More than 2 billion people use Facebook every month. 1.3 billion check in every day, and more than 1.5 billion use YouTube. Other services owned by these companies have user populations of over a billion. And Facebook and Alphabet are huge because users of those things are willing to trade privacy and openness for, convenient and free. While content creators resisted at first, user demand forced them to surrender control and profits to Facebook and the owner of Google. And the sad truth is that both of those companies have behaved irresponsibly in their pursuit of massive profits and consciously combined technologies and pervasive techniques developed by propagandists and the gambling industry with technology in ways that threaten public health. Oh, and democracy, too, as if that might not be a good thing when all is said and done. The issue, though, is not social networking or search. It's business models and advertising. The author says, from the earliest days of tabloid newspapers, publishers realized the power of exploiting human emotions. And to win a battle for their attention, publishers have to give users what they want. Everybody remembers the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. It's guided editorial choices for over 150 years. But it's really only become a threat, says the author, to society in the past decade, since the introduction of smartphones. Because modern media delivery platforms, from newspapers and TV to books and even computers, might be pervasive, but people only engage with them for a few hours each day, and everybody gets the same content. Today's battle for attention, though, is not a fair fight. Every competitor exploits the same techniques, but Facebook and Alphabet/Google have prohibitive advantages. They literally own personalization and smartphones. Unlike older media, Facebook and Alphabet know essentially everything about their users. They track them everywhere they go, on the web and beyond. And as a result, they're able to monetize content through advertising that's targeted more precisely than has ever been possible before. They literally create filter bubbles around each user, confirming pre-existing beliefs and often creating the illusion that everyone shares the same views. Platforms do this because it's profitable. The downside of filter bubbles is that beliefs become even more rigid and extreme. Users are less open to new ideas and even to new facts. Related articles by McNamee go even further and point out the connections, the obvious connections your host would add, to Joseph Goebbels and Nazi propaganda, and Edward Bernays, too, the father of modern advertising and PR, who famously promoted smoking to women. And if that wasn't bad enough, as other authors have pointed out at some length, people who sell their lives and souls to Facebook and Google have also sold out their economies along with them. Because basically, they spend their time checking out what their friends are doing rather than being productive. The world has never seen such technologies and such intensity, depth of, or dependence on information for its own sake, says Meir. To the point that about the only growth left in America may be Big Brother partnered companies spying on Americans. Yeah, and everybody else too. This week had a lot of other interesting news that kind of show us where the world is headed. Venezuela defaulted on a major set of government bonds. There was a military coup in Zimbabwe. And China's threatening the usual, but politely. They showed off their DFZF hypersonic dragon that is supposed to be able to evade missile defenses and nuke anybody they want. Hint, hint. And they suggested, also politely, that U.S. military exercises in the vicinity of the Korean Peninsula were getting kind of old. Better tone that down. There's a different kind of coup continuing in Saudi Arabia. It's hard to say exactly how that one's going to come out. The only thing we know for sure is that eventually, although it hasn't happened yet, the aged and some would say senile king of Saudi Arabia will abdicate, almost certainly to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's been consolidating his power already, and basically now has said, hey, all of you former princes, if you'll give us lots and lots of money, to the tune of billions, we might let you see the light of day again. And since some of them have been U.S. deep state and fiat petrodollar friendly, as you might suspect, a whole lot of questions are being raised. Meanwhile, what all this means to the U.S. is kind of fascinating and certainly not yet determined. Bottom line, though, according to any number of observers that your host has followed for quite a while, is expect the yuan for oil trade to expand. There have been continuing signs that Saudi Arabia is cozying up to Russia and China, things like weapons purchases and, of course, wanting to make financial deals, not for U.S. dollars. So about all we know with certainty is that no fiat currency in history, like the U.S. dollar, has ever survived long term. The dollar is getting pretty long in the tooth anyway, and what's happening in Saudi Arabia may just be one of the final nails in the coffin. Along those lines, the European Central Bank this week released a somewhat terse memo indicating that the deposit protection scheme in Europe is no longer necessary. What does that mean? Expect a bail-in. It's kind of like a theft warning in advance. The banksters there are evidently warning depositors. No, it wasn't your money to begin with, and now we want you to know you're not even protected. Call it a word to the wise. And that may be one of the few stories this week where I'm not talking about the whoppers people are getting fed, other than the fact that your savings are supposed to be secure, right? Yeah, sure. At this point, folks, I will suggest that the bottom line for all of these whoppers, lies, and of course, things that amount to the ministry of truth, as George Orwell put it in his book 1984, one way or another, amount to undermining what was once called truth, justice, and the American way. If you remember the old Superman TV show, it's a joke nowadays, especially when you look at the likes of Hitlery, the scumbags of Hollywood and the deep state, the Obamas, the George Soroses, et al., and those who have literally been seeking an Islamic invasion to undermine what's left of the rule of law. It's almost a fait accompli in Europe, and it's well underway here, too. I've got several stories that'll help outline where all this is headed and why it's so important. I'm looking at one from Breitbart to start us off. Sweden, says the headline. It doesn't matter if rapists are migrants, only that they're men. There's a great big picture of some sycophants there in Sweden under a banner that says, Refugees Welcome. And Chris Tomlinson's piece begins this way. Sweden's justice minister, yeah sure, has rejected a proposal by the moderate party to record the ethnic background of sex attackers, saying the only thing that matters is that they're men. Yeah, if too many of them yell Allahu Akbar, people might figure it out anyway. Justice Minister Morgan Johansson said that the moderates wanted to simply blame the rise in sex crimes on migrants, even though that seems to certainly be the correlation and the causality here. Instead, arguing that all criminals should be treated equally, even if there aren't very many of the other kind. And he also went on to claim that sex attacks occur among all ethnicities and backgrounds in Sweden, according to broadcaster SVT. And while that may be technically true, your former engineer host adds, he just doesn't want you to know the numbers involved. Quote, the common denominator of those who commit these crimes is that they are men, said Johansson, adding, the moderates are pulling out of talking about the men's role in all of this and instead just want to blame the immigrants. Earlier this year, populist Swedish Democrats made a similar proposal when they too asked the government for information relating to the relationship between migration and crime. They were stiff-armed. Sweden blocked all the requests for such data. And guess what? The same guy, Johansson, was involved there too, along with his notoriety, for refusing totally to even consider stripping the citizenship of Islamic State fighters returning to Sweden from the Middle East. No, that wouldn't be progressive enough. And of course, Johansson rejected that earlier request too, saying the following, get this, Sweden's earlier figures in numerous international studies all show much the same thing. Minority groups are often overrepresented in crime statistics, but when controlling for socioeconomic factors, this disappears almost entirely, unquote. And of course, if we deny you the data, we can make it disappear completely. From news source Gefira in Poland, via Zero Hedge, under the headline, EU, would you believe it has values? Well, anyway, whatever they call values fit Poland like the saddle fits the cow. Folks there are evidently chafing under the social justice warrior yoke. We want God, says one of the chants that begins the piece. Great independent Poland, another on a sign. Death to the enemies of the fatherland. Christ is Poland's king. Deus Vult, Latin for God wills, the battle cry of the Crusaders. All of these are special and principal banners carried in the annual Independence March held in Warsaw, as well as other cities across Poland on 11 November, Independence Day. Tens of thousands of people, says the story, waving tens of thousands of red and white national flags, young and old and of all walks of life, with whole families, took to the streets, and those participating in the march thought of themselves as patriot, a word which, in Poland at least, still has positive overtones, paying tribute to fallen heroes and rejecting the Islamic invasion of Europe, it would seem. To the Western media, says the coverage, these are all Nazis, racists, anti-Semites, and, of course, Islamophobes, abomination to the European Union. What has positive overtones in Poland, patriotism, faith, and family, seems to have very negative ones in the rest of Western Europe, and the other way around. Migrants, LGBTQ, etc., and gender mainstreaming is not welcome in that area between the Oder and Bug rivers. EU values, in other words, could not be further from Poland's, and vice versa. At the time when the Soviets were establishing their communist political system in Central Europe, someone once said, ascribing these words to Stalin himself, that communism fits the Polish nation like a saddle fits a cow. And it might be said the same thing is true today when it comes to attempts to Europeanize Poles. Is this another attempt, concludes Zero Hedge, at saddling the cow? All of which leads me now to a piece that perhaps fairly succinctly describes where all of this seems to be headed. This comes from Jeremiah Johnson, nom de plume, of a retired Green Beret and United States Army Special Forces Airborne member, now a gunsmith, master herbalist, and prolific author, writing again for SHTF Plan. Europe, he says, is the prime example of what he believes is coming for the United States. Quote, this modern invasion makes Saladin's armies pale in comparison. Normally, he begins, this topic is covered gingerly, and with the First Amendment of the Constitution having been subverted by political social correctness doctrines, it's sure to draw unwanted attention. Europe, though, is still the prime example of what is coming to the United States. Countries such as Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands, and France, the heart of the warrior crusader Europe in medieval times, have absolutely now kowtowed to what is nothing less than a Muslim invasion. And yes, he says, this modern one makes Saladin's armies pale by comparison. The news is reporting the giveaway of traditionally Christian lands of European states to Muslim aliens crossing borders ceaselessly, on foot, by plane, train, car, and by boat. This is a mass exodus in all directions, writes Jeremiah Johnson, targeting all nations. Oligarchs such as Soros and politicos such as Merkel are fostering this exodus, backed up by the International Court of The Hague. These socialist progressives want to destroy the ethnic homogeneity and religion, language, and culture of all of these nations to usher in globalism. And it's not just globalism, folks. It's communist, socialist, Marxist, fascist, public-private partnership-ist globalism, with the goal of railing in and controlling the Islamist extremists later. And as he points out, this is the organizing the organized strategy, popularized by Obama's mentor, Saul Alinsky. Jeremiah Johnson, though, believes it will backfire on them. The Islamists will come in and establish their foothold, and anyone who does not submit among the unbelievers, they call them the Al-Harb, will be dealt with. Dar al-Harb, of course, is the house of war, phonetically translated from the Arabic, and this has to do with the philosophy and doctrine known as holy war or jihad, an institution meant to extend the rule of Islam into that Dar al-Harb, into the lands of the Gentile unbelievers. And guess what? He says they're doing it. America is beset from within by communists and socialists under the guise of progressivism who wish to completely destroy the borders, language, and culture of the United States. And all of the news we're seeing today makes that point, your host interjects. They're pretty transparently using Saul Alinsky's tactics. And you can look to Europe to see how successful it's been. In addition to Poland, which I just mentioned, he notes the only other countries fighting that influx are Italy, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, although they're still having to deal with the siege of The Hague, while in the United States we can already see the carefully constructed policy of ensconcing all of Islamist extremism and Sharia law into the schools, universities, as well as local and state governments. They're doing it, not simply allowing it to happen. And it's pretty obvious in the process that they're willing to do it to anyone who admits what's going on, or especially dares to try and fight back. Make no mistake, says Jeremiah Johnson, this is a war of conquest of a different kind than we've seen before. This is the kind where the conquerors are invited in and are conquering lands held by those too blind to realize what's happening until it's too late. And all of this constitutes just one more threat, along with fostered civil strife and political discord in the U.S. domestically. Next, look for Reconquista in the state of Aztlan to be pushed too, getting the illegals from Central and South America and Mexico into the fray, gutting the country from within and weakening it. And of course, let's not forget, the media is now pushing the gun grab. It's pretty obvious the false flags are intended to accelerate until they drop the final hammer, because Americans owning firearms seem to be the only thing still holding them back. And given what's already happened to truth and the First Amendment, it's equally obvious where all of this is headed. I've suggested for a long time that there is such a thing as truth, and then there are those who play God on TV. Which is why for the rest of us, it's vital to know who we really serve. We'll be right back.